Welcome again, and my name is Andy Newberry, and I lead the Wednesday night Old Testament lecture series, and I just want to say thank you to the people who've been helping lead and facilitate our time in worship together. So, Dana, thank you for praying, and Carol, thank you for welcoming Rick for your time of silence. Yes. and for Marissa and the children's time and the praise brigade and all of you guys, thank you. For tonight's service and sermon, we've been going through a series on the book of Proverbs. Not really the whole book, actually just a couple of verses. And if you want to grab your Bibles and open them up, we're in Proverbs chapter 6. If you have one of these little black Bibles in the chairs, it's on page 513. And there are a few words in particular that we've chosen to focus on. And these are found starting in verses 16, and it goes to verse 19. And I want to read this, and then let us sit in this text for a little time tonight and focus on a few words in particular. But listen to these few verses. There are six things that the Lord hates, seven that are an abomination to him. Haughty eyes, a lying tongue, and hands that shed innocent blood. A heart that devises wicked plans, feet that hurry to run to evil, a lying witness who testifies falsely, and one who sows discord in a family. Tonight we're going to focus on that third statement in that series of the six things or seven things that God hates, and it's hands that shed innocent blood. Now as I read this, I think, wow, that's a pretty potent phrase to have to preach on, and it's been a while since I've preached, and Christian warned me not to pack in a year and a half of material in the next however much time we have. So I set my stopwatch to make sure I don't go over. Just start yelling at me if it's like dawn. But in this text, that there are these different things that God hates, specifically hands that shed innocent blood, there are a whole host of questions that start to come up to my mind, like, what does it mean for God to hate? What does it mean to have hands that shed innocent blood? What would that look like? What are the hands of God like? Who is innocent? Whose blood are we talking about? Why does it say six things and then seven? Why not just say seven? And as I sort through all these different questions, certain answers come to mind that help me understand what is the core, what is the crux of this text. Years ago, in fact, over 260 years ago, there was a very famous sermon that was preached by this guy named Jonathan Edwards. How many people have ever heard of this guy? Okay, a handful of people, maybe some English majors especially should have heard of this guy, but especially theology students should also know this guy. And he preached this sermon called, does anyone know it? Yes, I hope you all heard it. It's Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. And he preached this fire and brimstone sermon. And when he preached this sermon, it was one of the typical sermons of what was called the Great Awakening in American history, in American religious history. And the imagery that he had was essentially that the people in his congregations whom he was preaching were a lot like spiders, insects, loathsome things that were just hanging over these fiery pits of hell and just held on by God. Some of the quotes he says, the God that holds you over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider or some loathsome insect over the fire, abhors you and is dreadfully provoked. His wrath towards you burns like fire. He looks upon you as worthy of nothing else but to be cast into the fire. It goes on to say, and yet it is nothing but his hand that holds you from falling into the fire every moment. It goes on. And there is no other reason to be given why you have not dropped into hell since you arose this morning, but God's hand has held you up. Amen. And the sermon's over. You'd be warm and well fed. No, he preached this fire and brimstone sermon that scared the bejesus out of people. And I'm not going to knock the sermon. At that day, in that time, maybe that was a great word that needed to be heard by those people. But I know today, for the ears that come into this group, though having heard various things in the various walks of life that you come from, there might be a different kind of word that you need to hear from. And that while there are many times within our media, within our culture, that church, God, Jesus, when words like this come up, people imagine this kind of preaching. People imagine a fire and brimstone message where certain people claim to speak for God, presume to understand everything about God, and upon their lofty pedestals speak down to people, speak down words of judgment and condemnation, as if they have understood the love of God, as if they have earned the love of God, and delight in withholding the love of God from other people. That sort of a message, that sort of a hell, fire, and brimstone message, I would say is an abomination in and of itself. That anyone who has known the love of God, like we sung about in that song, Paper Sky, if we know about the love of God, we could write about it all day long, all night long, for the rest of our lives, and still only begin to scratch the surface. When we have known the love of God, we will not feel as though we are given some privileged position by which to speak words of condemnation to others. Now, that's not to say that when we see others doing wrong and hurting themselves, that we have nothing to say, but it is as fellow sinners, not as those who have arrived, not as those who have a privileged special status, but it is people who understand that though there might be an image of sinners in the hands of an angry God, that there might be a different metaphor, a different picture, a different word that the people around us today need to hear. Because when I picture, what in the world would it even mean to have, an angry God's hands look like? That sort of an image somewhat baffles me, though I'll come back to that later. Tonight, this sermon will be of a different tenor than that one by Jonathan Edwards, though it is well worth reading, and I would say take a look at it. But as I start to think on this particular phrase from Proverbs that we're looking at, that there are six things the Lord hates, I'll say up front, when I heard we were going to do this, I got a little bit anxious, a little bit queasy in my stomach. And the reason for that is this. Whenever I hear somebody say, God hates, I'm just waiting for that next line, and I'm cringing as I hear it. Whenever, and maybe some of you have had that similar experience, I'm not sure where each of you comes from in terms of your understanding of the Bible and who God is and what your relationship with God might be like. But for me, as a person who has known God, who has followed the God of the Bible as much as I can for years, when I hear people presume to speak for God and start off by saying, let me tell you who God hates, let me tell you how God hates, I start to get really nervous and queasy, and it just makes me uncomfortable. And I know that I'm going to have a tendency to want to downplay that part of this text because there are so many absolutely awful and abusive and wrong ways that people have casually used it in reference to God. And I'll say this, though, that even though my knee-jerk reaction is to get anxious when I start hearing people talk about, you know, who God hates and how God hates and why God hates, I can't let the presence of those obnoxious people, I'm going to call them obnoxious people when they presume to speak for God on matters that God does not speak. Even though there are some people like that, I don't want to let that deter me from speaking honestly about the things that the Bible does clearly say. And in this passage, the Bible clearly says there are six things that the Lord hates, seven that are an abomination to Him. It doesn't say, well, there are six things that God would be a little bit happier if they didn't exist. The person writing this uses such powerful language that God has breathed into these words the strongest statement that he possibly can, that there are things that God hates. And so though there might be some people who talk about God hating in a way that makes me cringe, because I think that they add in their own opinions or political agendas or social agendas or economic agendas and just use God's name as a cover for that, though there might be those obnoxious people who do that, I don't want to let that deter me from looking honestly at this text and what it says. And I think that there's one thing about God that those people have no clue about, that when they so passionately speak about God's hate, I think that oftentimes the thing that they most don't understand is the thing that we most need to grasp tonight. And that is the love of God. That to understand God's hate would be a ridiculous endeavor if we don't understand God's love. God's great, effective, redeeming, holy, merciful, loyal, covenantal love. We need to grasp this idea of love, which in Hebrew is this word hesed, this covenantal loyal love, before we can grasp what hate means. Because the hate of God is only understood in the light of the love of God. Because when we see who God loves, we'll understand why there might be something he hates. When we understand for whom God is passionate, we'll understand why he is pained by certain things. And I'll say this, God is passionate about people. And so when we hurt one another, it hurts God. God loves his people. We are created in his image. And when we hurt and even murder one another, that offends God. That hurts God because we are his children. And I could imagine for you parents out there, Larissa just got to sweep your kids away and you see them up front and you, I would hope, care very, very much about them. But if you were to see somebody else come and hurt your kids, you would be outraged. You would start throwing over these chairs and start throwing them at people if anyone were to hurt them. And that would be a right reaction. Jesus says if anyone hurts the least of these, they should tie a millstone around their neck and throw them into the sea. That when people hurt our kids, that is offensive and grievous and awful. And so when God says that he hates hands that shed innocent blood, that is driven by the fact that he loves us, his people, and doesn't want us hurting one another. So when we talk about God's hate, though there might be some people who use that phrase to speak about things that I would say the Bible does not address, let us not let that prevent us from seeing what this text is clearly saying, that when we hurt one another, we are hurting God, our Creator. So what is the context then of this phrase, hands that shed innocent blood? But there's two main ideas, and these are the two main ideas I want us to latch onto then tonight. When we think about hands that shed innocent blood, for the Israelites at the time that the Proverbs were written, when they heard that phrase, two ideas would have come to their mind. Two key ideas would have come to their mind, and it's this, murder and sacrifice. That the Israelites would have heard hands that shed innocent blood, right away in their head, they're thinking about murder, and they're thinking about sacrifice. Well, let me start with the idea of murder. In the Ten Commandments, there's a very specific commandment. You guys probably all know it. What's it say? Thou shalt not murder. It's really clear. And while it might seem like a rather straightforward command, I probably should elaborate it on a little bit. The command is not do not kill. There is a different Hebrew word for kill than for murder. And so there is a distinction made in that text. Now, in other parts of the law of God that was given through Moses, topics of killing are addressed more fully, but just in the Ten Commandments, it says, do not murder. And for each case of murder within the law, there are different consequences prescribed, different methods of enacting judgment that are prescribed. But what is it about murder that is so heinous to God that it makes the top 10? What is it about murder that's so offensive that it's in the Ten Commandments? And while I think the answer to that should be kind of obvious, like, murder is bad. If we don't get that, you know, we're going to have a remedial church class afterward and you can come talk to me. I kind of joke about it, but then there are times in history and in the world where people just don't get that. And it's by the grace of God we're fortunate to not be in that experience right now. But I would say that in addition to just sort of intuitively knowing murder is bad, when we hurt one another, whether it's actually murdering them, whether it's doing violence to them, whether it's abusing people physically, mentally, emotionally, relationally, when we hurt one another, we are not only hurting another human. For in whose image are we created? We're created in the image of God. And when we hurt one another, we are hurting the image of God in that person. And it grieves God. It grieves God because he cares about us, because he has made us. It grieves God because when we hurt one another, he sees us lashing out at his mirrored reflection in the eyes of one another, and it pains him. And he calls us to live in a different manner, that every person, no matter how they are perceived by society, whether they are perceived as being good people or bad people, whether they are perceived as having great value or little value, whether they have great wealth or prestige, every single person created is created in the image of God, and therefore has an inherent dignity and respect. And God commands us to give that sort of dignity and respect to one another. And when we fail to do this, we offend God. That when we do violence to one another, we do violence against the image of God that we carry around. Now, in addition to the Ten Commandments, Jesus follows up on this commentary on the Ten Commandments in the Sermon on the Mount. And he tells the people following him at that time, you know, you've heard it said, do not murder. But I say to you, do not even be angry with me. Now, that's going to start to push some of our buttons. I know that each of us might have different buttons which can be pushed. Each of us might have different temper levels at which we hit our breaking point. But for all of us, it is easy to become angry if the right button is pushed. And it is easy to become angry at one another when we push that button. Now, picture for a minute right now, who is it that's been pushing your buttons? Who is it that just knows how to needle you and get to you and drive you crazy? For a lot of you, I know that those people who can most easily push your buttons are the people that you want to care for the most. But maybe it's family members. Maybe it's people that you care about in a romantic way. Maybe it's people that, maybe it's your brother, your sister, your friend, your coworker, whomever. It's the people closest to you that are usually most able to just get to you. And as you hear words from Jesus saying things like, do not be angry with one another, you want to say, okay, I'll accept that, except for this person at this time when he does this or she does that. But Jesus doesn't give us any disclaimers. He doesn't give us any passes as if to say, well, it's okay to be angry at this person. It's okay to be angry at that person. I understand. I get it. I'm Jesus. I know how that works. No. Do not be angry at one another. There are no exceptions being made there. Now, this isn't primarily a sermon about anger, and I could speak at length about that. But I'll simply say this with regard to anger. It is not the feeling itself of anger that Jesus is condemning. For the Bible in Ephesians that Paul talks about, in your anger, do not sin. That there are times where anger will naturally be an emotion that comes up. The question is, what do we do with that anger when it rises up? That when the person cuts you off on the highway, when the person cuts me off on the highway, before I start to like catch up to them and smash into them because, well, quite frankly, I don't care about my car. It's a piece of junk. But before I do that, I think, okay, you know, here's this feeling of anger. Why am I feeling so angry? What is it that I want to do? Why do I want to do violence? I'll say this about anger. Most anger comes up and overwhelms us when we feel a loss of control, especially a loss of control in a situation where we think we should have control. Now, when I drive, I think I have control. I know what I'm doing. My car, though a piece of junk, at least it works. And when I turn it, it turns. When I hit the accelerator, it accelerates. When I hit the brake, it brakes. So I assume when I'm driving from my house to where I'm going to be working, that I have control over that. But when somebody so rudely dispels that myth that I have control over my life and my environment, I instantly get angry and I want to lash out in violence. And for us, I want to say, don't give in to that anger. Don't first believe the lie that you have control over everything, because if you did, then you would be gone, and then all of these would be moot issues. But given that we don't have control over all these situations, don't feed into that anger that's been so easily overwhelmed. I want us to look at one story that I think really highlights this, and it's in the book of Genesis. So if you have these Bibles at the very beginning, in Genesis chapter 4, here is a story of not just anger, but of murder. And not just any murder, it's the first murder that gets recorded in the Bible. And in this story, I think we will see more clearly what it is about hands that shed innocent blood that offends God. But more importantly than that, I think we're going to see how God responds to that. I think if we were to try to figure out what does that picture look like for God to actually take hands that shed innocent blood, the picture that is painted in the scriptures might be different than the way we imagine. That for me, when I imagine how does God respond to hands that shed innocent blood, I'm picturing that fire and brimstone. I'm picturing that Jonathan Edwards sermon of those spiders being dangled over fire and just God going, oops, and you're gone. That's sort of my conception that I would normally think about. But it amazes me how God describes himself in Genesis. Listen to these words, chapter 4 of Genesis, page 3, starting in verse 1. Now the man knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have produced a man to help the Lord. Next, she bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a tiller of the ground. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel, for his part, brought the firstlings of his flock, their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. The Lord said to Cain, why are you angry, and why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is lurking at your door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it. Can we pause there? God is actually talking to Cain. So here's Cain, here's Abel. We kind of are familiar with the rough pictures of the story, like there are these two brothers and one gets killed. But God intervenes in the middle of the story, and he kind of has a little time out with Cain, and he says, Cain, I see you're really upset. Like, I can see it on your face, you look downcast, and I know why you're so upset. And this thing, sin, he talks about it in this personified way. Sin is, it's almost like it's crouching at your door. Picture sin crouching at your door. It wants to have you. It wants to master you. But instead you can kind of control the situation. You don't have to give into your anger. You can do what is right. Now imagine yourselves for a moment with those people who are needling and getting at you and pushing your buttons. And that temptation that you have to give into anger, to give into violence, whether it's through your words or even through your fists. When you feel most tempted, visualize this scene. God calling you aside, saying to you clearly, in no uncertain terms, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must master it. Every single time we feel that temptation to give into our anger, to do violence to one another, I believe that God can speak to us and that we never have to give into that, that the choice is there before us to choose a better way. Now, Cain has the benefit of God himself speaking to him. And Cain does what we all imagine he would do when God tells us to do something. He goes ahead and does it anyway. Cain said to his brother Abel, let's go out to the field. And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel, killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, where's your brother Abel? He said, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? And the Lord said, what have you done? Listen, your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground. And now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it will no longer yield to you its strength. You will be a fugitive and a wanderer on earth. And Cain said to the Lord, my punishment is greater than I can bear. Today you have driven me away from the soil, and I shall be hidden from your face. I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on earth, and anyone who meets me may kill me. Then the Lord said to him, not so. Whoever kills Cain will suffer a sevenfold vengeance. And the Lord put a mark on Cain, so that no one who came upon him would kill him. Then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. So Cain, after getting that very specific pep talk from God, more than a pep talk, very direct, don't do this talk from God. He goes out, kills his brother, and then when God calls him out on it, he doesn't deny it, he doesn't run away from it, as Adam and Eve did in the chapter before this, but he just says, what have you done? He just says, I do not know, am I my brother's keeper? He doesn't hide, he just sort of just stands there and kind of takes whatever God is going to throw at him. And when God tells him his punishment, that he's going to be sent out and be a wanderer. He says, this is too much for me to bear. Now, I imagine, if I'm Cain, I'm expecting I'm going to die. That when God says, don't kill your brother, and then you go and you do, and God confronts you, I'm picturing the lightning, like the lightning that was going on earlier today. I'm picturing that hitting him and killing him. But he doesn't get that. And yet he still complains about his punishment. And so Cain is worried that other people are now going to murder him. And God says, that's not going to happen, Cain. I'm going to put a mark on you. Now, what is this mark? How does this work? Who are these other people? Come to the Wednesday class. We'll talk about that. But for tonight, I'll just say they're all there, and I'm not going to get into it. But he's worried that other people are now going to murder him, and God says, no, this cycle of violence is going to stop right now. I do not delight in this cycle of violence. I do not delight in bloodshed. I didn't want you to murder your brother. I don't want other people to murder you. This grieves me. I hate this. God hates hands that shed innocent blood. And he even, I would say, hates hands that shed guilty blood. It's baffling to me. But to this guy, Cain, God shows mercy when he should have gotten so much retribution. So when the early Israelites read about hands that shed innocent blood, I am sure that they were thinking about murder. Probably this first murder with Cain. But they were not only thinking about murder, they were probably thinking about sacrifice. Now this is a part we all here today in the 21st century North America probably aren't thinking right away when we hear, oh, shedding innocent blood. I'm picturing some lambs and goats and bulls getting sacrificed. But the Israelites, they would have done that. Because in the law is those instructions that God gave to Israel through Moses. In the law, especially in the book of Leviticus, there are all sorts of details and descriptions given about how to be made right with God. And the way that people were made right with God was the shedding of blood, specifically the taking an animal that was pure and blameless and spotless, bringing it to the priest, who would then slaughter it, and then that blood would be sprinkled on the altar on behalf of the guilty Israelite, on behalf of the sinful person. And for these Israelites, that was a regular part of their existence, that usually at least on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, that was something they would have seen. But for a lot of the Israelites, this was probably a regular occurrence that they were used to seeing animals getting slaughtered all the time. Now, try to imagine that bloody scene, that the sights, the smells, the sounds. For me, when I went to seminary, I went out to seminary in Hatfield, Pennsylvania, and Jared was there. He's going there now. The seminary is a great place. I really enjoyed it. It happened to be very, very close, though, to another place called the Hatfield Quality Meats. And at the Hatfield Quality Meats, they did kind of what you can imagine. They slaughtered lots of animals to package their pork products and all these other things. It's like, the nickname is Home of the Smiling Pork. And it's got this ridiculous-looking smiling cow or smiling pig. But when I would smell just the outside anywhere near there, I'm not picturing like a smiling pig. It is a stench. It is an atrocious, awful stench. When I would be driving sometimes, I would get stuck behind the trucks that were going to the plants, and it was just awful, and there was no escaping. Sometimes, even from the seminary itself, I would occasionally get a whiff of just the funk that was coming out of the Hatfield Quality Meats. That sort of a stench is just what happens when you have lots of animals that are getting slaughtered and butchered. For the Israelites, that bloody, that loud, that smell, that mess was just the norm for them. Now, I want you to imagine that you're some young Israelite living in that culture, in that day, hearing those sounds. Imagine, actually, you're a young Israelite with a little one-year-old baby lamb or whatever, and you're walking that lamb to the temple, and you know exactly what's going to happen. And you're walking that lamb to the temple, not just because it seems like a nice idea, but because you did something wrong. Because you're guilty, and that little lamb is going to get butchered because of something you did. That, how would you feel if you were that Israelite doing that? Well, it's not called a guilt offering for nothing. I mean, that's a lousy experience. And then I think, how would I feel if I was an old Israelite doing the same exact thing? Would I have grown calloused over the years if walking these animals, you know, day after day, year after year to the temple to be sacrificed, these innocent animals sacrificed for my guilt? Would I just become accustomed to it, or would it still get to me? I think then of the high priest of Israel at that time, and how he must have felt having to butcher all of these innocent animals day after day after day on behalf of all of these guilty people, even on behalf of myself, this guilty priest. How would my hands feel? How would my hands feel being caked with blood, covered under the fingernails and every part of me just having little animal bits, because that's all I'm doing all the time? I would imagine that it's got to get to me. I had a friend of mine, his name was Josh, and Josh used to work in this lab before he went to medical school, and what he did in the lab, he worked on animals that were being tested for traumatic brain injury. And the result of this work was to do really good medical research to help humans who've suffered massive brain trauma. But his job, being the low man on the totem pole, was to actually cause the massive brain trauma to these, first it started with rats, and then it became pigs. And without being too graphic, he had to cause a lot of brain trauma to these animals. And there was machines that would do it, and he'd have to wrestle these pigs into it. And when he first started the job, he was very freaked out. And this was a guy who, you know, as kids, like, I would see him do all sorts of gross things. He would, like, eat a tablespoon of salt just for a bet, which he lost. But he would, you know, we would all do dumb things as kids. But, you know, after college, he's doing these things. And Josh, even though he has a strong stomach for things, was really freaked out by it and said it was really hard for him to handle day after day taking these rats, taking these pigs, and just doing what he had to do to them. Though over time, he said he kind of got used to it. Months went on, and it became routine. Though he said after about a year, it stopped being routine, and it got to him. And he kept hearing the pigs, he kept picturing the rats, and he finally just had to quit because he couldn't handle having to, time and time again, just abuse those animals. Even though the result of that work was really good, it was helping people who were suffering greatly. Anyone who's had a friend or family member suffer brain trauma can appreciate the fruit of that kind of medical research. But if you're the guy involved, it's a miserable experience. And I picture that high priest feeling like his hands were just covered with blood of innocent animals for guilty people, and it would weigh upon them. These hands that I have, or the hands that I would have if I were the high priest, would get to me as I stared at them each day. And I think, and probably all of us should ask this question, why is it that way? I mean, if we don't wonder, why would God make up such a system as to have such a bloody ritual going on? Like, why does that happen? And I'll say, I can't fully explain it, but I can give you a few insights. The law clearly says, do not. However, for all of us who have taught, we know that sometimes you might say something to your students, and you think, why aren't they getting it? You just say something once, and you expect them to latch on right away, and that you say the right words and formulate it as carefully as you can. You think, why aren't these words affecting my students enough? But when you start to make it visual and visceral, and you add in scents and sounds and odors into the lesson that you're doing, it becomes a whole lot more effective. And even though I could probably try to lay out in mathematical terms the ways that we ought to treat one another, I can make the best logical formulations of how we should love one another and care for one another. Sometimes those rational, logical formulations are just insufficient to keep us from sinning, hurting one another. But I think that God knows the math of sin is a lot less provocative than a portrait. That when God paints a picture of sin, says, here's the consequence. Remember that little lamb you walked up? Aren't you getting tired of doing that? And if I were an Israelite at that time, to me, the experience of walking that lamb to the temple on a regular basis would get to me a lot more than just words, words, words. Don't hurt each other. Words, words, words. Do not do this. Well, those words don't always get me, but that experience of seeing the sacrifice, seeing the atonement happen, seeing the price that is enacted in order for us to be right with God would be a really effective teacher for me. And God institutes such a system. In Hebrews, it sort of summarizes this whole system where it says, Moses had proclaimed every commandment of the law to the people. He took the blood of calves together with water, scarlet wool, and branches of hyssop, and sprinkled the scroll and all the people. He said, this is the blood of the covenant which God has commanded you to keep. In the same way, he sprinkled the blood, both the tabernacle, he sprinkled with the blood, both the tabernacle and everything used in its ceremonies. In fact, the law requires that nearly everything be cleansed with blood, for without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. But that is the institution God has set up, that through the shedding of this innocent blood, there can be forgiveness. How does that work exactly? I don't know. I can't explain it in mathematical, rational, linear terms. I just know that this is the portrait of being made right with God, that God himself is painting. And it is not a neat and tidy and pretty one, but it is the one that he has made. And so, how does this play out? Well, I think it's most clearly seen in the Gospels, in the end of the Gospels, when Jesus is on the cross. And you know the scene if you've read this, if you've heard it, if you've been to church anytime, anywhere near Easter, as Jesus is being crucified and all of these onlookers are surrounding him, he says to God his Father, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. And he divided up their clothes by casting lots. The Israelites would have heard these words, God hates hands that shed innocent blood. They would have heard those words thinking about murder, sacrifice. As we hear these words, I want us to think, yes, we should stop hurting one another. We should stop being a part of a culture of violence in which we are so deeply embedded. And I want us to run away from those cycles of getting into anger and hurting one another. But I also want us to latch onto this idea of sacrifice and redemption. Because if I were to ask you, what do the hands of the angry God look like? I would hope that the answer would be this, that the hands of an angry God, and by the anger I mean God who is angry at the ways we hurt him, the hands of an angry God are pierced, the hands of an angry God are bloody by his self-sacrifice for us. The most amazing part of the gospel to me is this, that though God hates hands that shed innocent blood, it is his own hands that shed his own innocent blood for us, the guilty people who are guilty of shedding his blood. That's how God hates. He sacrifices himself. This doesn't make any mathematical sense. This doesn't add up. But this is what the love of God is like. That he hates all of this innocent blood being shed, so he stops that cycle by shedding his own blood. And that when we are here tonight and we hear these words, I want us to walk away with these words of grace. That I don't know how much guilt we might be walking into here with tonight. I don't know how much pain others have caused you. I don't know the extent to the hurt that you're bringing to these seats and to this community. But God hates the way we hurt one another. God hates injustice and violence and oppression. And when the Bible asks questions like, what does God want of us? He wants us to love justice and to do justice and love mercy and walk humbly with God. And so we know that this is what God is like. He hates all of those miserable ways that we're so miserable to each other. And the way that he deals with us is not by striking us with lightning. It is not to, like Cain might have worried about, that we would just be wiped off the face of the earth. The way that God displays his hate for the way that we hurt one another is to shed his own blood for us. And when we celebrate this communion table, we will remember that. When we see that body, that bread broken, we will remember when his body was broken for us. When we see the wine and the juice being poured, we'll remember the way Jesus' blood was poured out for us. That is what the love of God is like. So, what do we do in light of this? I just want to say then a couple points of application. How do we respond to the truth that God hates hands that shed innocent blood, I'll say there's a couple things I want us to stop doing, and it's this. Stop being part of the injustice process, both directly and indirectly. That there are a whole host of ways that it is really easy to be a part of the process of injustice. We need to stop it. Now, the very upfront part, don't commit murder. I know if some of you are walking in thinking about that, but don't do it, please. But further, don't commit violence. Don't commit oppression. Through your words, through your actions, through the ways that you treat people, by the ways that we keep people to the outside of our group, by the ways that we belittle people with our words, by our glances, by the ways we look down on people, the way we exclude people. Don't be a part of that. Stop perpetuating violence by our excessive consumerism. There is a whole culture within this country where we're just funding a lot of money to hurt a lot of people. And I'm not going to, there's so many political things that come up that I'm completely going to avoid. But there are ways that the way we spend our money leads to people being hurt. And stop being a part of that. Instead, though, what I do want to encourage us to do is this. Start or continue being part of the solution of justice. And I know there's a lot of ways in which you guys are already doing this. And if you are, great, please keep doing so. There are so many people here who are in high school, in college, or out of college and are trying to figure out what to do with their lives next. Well, I'll say this. Work for justice. Pick jobs that serve justice. Become lawyers, legislators, judges, politicians, police, family service workers, UN aid workers, relief workers. Be a part of, take those jobs. They're not the highest paying jobs for the most part, not the lawyers, but be a part of that justice system. Be a godly lawyer. What a great testimony that can be. I have met some, know some, and it is wonderful. Be a part of the solution of justice. You can also work for healing. Become doctors, nurses, EMS workers, firemen, men and women, therapists, counselors, ministers. Work for groups like IJM, the International Justice Mission. Be a part of these sorts of groups that work for healing. Help be a part of educating people about ways that we hurt one another and how we can stop that. Adopt kids. Become foster parents. Be a part of eliminating poverty and systemic injustice in the cause of so much bloodshed. Most importantly, though, preach the gospel. Tell people about Jesus. Tell people that there is hope, that there is love. Be a part of preaching hope so that when people hear the story of truth and reconciliation, that they would embrace it and realize that they can be loved and forgiven and healed. Be a part of this, and in so doing, realize how deeply God hates the ways that we hurt each other. Realize how deeply He hates hands that shed innocent blood. But when you do that, realize He is doing it with His own hands that have been pierced for us, and broken for us, and bled for us, so that He might show us His love. Let's pray.